Hello and welcome. I'm Patrick, your host for this presentation in the Inland Mariners audio series. This series is presented by the Inland Mariners in conjunction with Cypress Pictures and Patrick Lipinski. In this interview, I'm talking with Marshall Bundren, chaplain and director of the International Seafarers Center of Burns Harbor at Portage, Indiana.
Marshall, can you tell me a little bit about what your job entails in a nutshell?
Chaplaincy is taking the church outside the four walls of the church into to where the people are. And I'm involved in industrial chaplaincy. That is to say, we're taking it to the workplace rather than to the university or the hospital. I'm taking it to the workplace for the workers. The particular group I'm working with is seafarers, both international and domestic. And I'm doing that on the southern tip of Lake Michigan in northwest Indiana and northeast Illinois. That northeast Illinois business is Greater Chicago. And I've been doing that since the early 1970s, probably 1975 on.
Okay. How did you get started in this?
I came home from a two-year stint in the Army. I had been part of the last draft that our country had. And I was trained as a military policeman. And then more specifically, I was trained as a jailer, military policeman. This was at the tail end of the Vietnam era. And rather than send me to Vietnam, which I had volunteered for, I was sent to Europe. And I was assigned to an American prison in Furth, West Germany, which was a suburb of Nuremberg, where I spent about 17 months active duty. Got there, we were 100 people over staff, and they asked if anyone could type, which I had learned to do right after I got out of 8th grade. Raised my hand, and I spent the rest of my time in Germany in the office being a personnel clerk for the detachment that was taking care of that particular prison. It was an 9-to-5 job, Monday through Friday, weekends off in smack dab in the middle of Europe. And here I was, 20 years old. Fantastic. Just an amazing experience. I got to visit a lot of the countries of Europe. I had a great, great experience. If everyone could have the experience that I would have, I would be all in favor of mandatory national service for all young people. But a lot of the people we're with were miserable because they were separated from wives and children and things like that, which as a single man didn't affect me. But I really loved the experience, the broadening experience of living in Europe like that. But it ended, and I came home, and the letdown was just palpable. It was just awful. I came home in May of 74, and everything was just so gray to me, just awful. When I had been drafted, I was a sophomore at Indiana University on their commuter campus in Gary, Indiana. Went right straight back to Indiana University Northwest, took up where I left off, went right back to the church that I had been serving as organist when I was drafted, back on the organ bench again. Everything was the same, the same, the same, and that was very hard on me. One Sunday, we had a guest speaker. He was a Polish-American fellow named Cass Vincent, and he spoke to the church about a ministry he and his British-born wife were starting. They had seen in the newspaper that the government of Indiana had decided to build a deep water port on the southern tip of Lake Michigan, and he wanted to be there with a welcome center for seafarers from all around the world, and he needed volunteers to come and be friends with people from all over the world. Well, you talk about someone chucking me a life preserver, a lifesaver, that was it. I started volunteering with Cass and his wife, and this was during the time of the Cold War, you recall. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that began the thaw for that was when we gave millions and millions and millions of tons of grain to the Soviet Union. Of course, the grain had to be moved, and when you're moving something like that such distances, you move it on ships. Consequently, we had ships from all over the Soviet bloc coming to northwest Indiana to pick up corn, soybeans, and wheat. And so we had a lot of exposure to them. And I just was head over heels in love with the whole thing from my very first night of volunteering with him and her. I volunteered with the two of them until they moved on to another position on the East Coast. I volunteered with the couple that followed them, which ironically had been my next door neighbors all of my childhood. They were there for 5 years, and then I volunteered with the next fellow and his wife. He was, as the other two were, he was a pastor, technically a pastor, and he took a church, and there was a rule against that. So the search committee, on the basis of knowing my history with volunteering, asked if I wanted to do it, and I told them no, I did not feel a call to the ministry, but I would be their interim until they found the right man. Well, 7 years later, they said, you know, we think we found the right man, and it is you, and you don't have to be ordained, you don't have to be a pastor, etc. Our home mission board out of Atlanta, Georgia, at that time, would commission a non-clergy, and that's what happened. Several years later, I was commissioned and worked for the denomination until about 10 years ago when they decided they didn't want to do chaplaincy in any shape, form, or fashion anymore. And we were released, and since that time I've been doing it independently because I realized what they did not, feet on the ground as I were, that it wasn't the time to leave seafarers without chaplains. Things don't get better or haven't gotten better on the Great Lakes or internationally for 30 years at least. And, you know, there's just each ship, each crew is a big pressure cooker. So I decided to stay on independently, and I have done it independently for about the last 10 years.
Okay, very interesting. Marshall, what was the original, did you have a building in South Chicago? Where were you located, and how did that sort of work?
We were located in Burns Harbor, which is in the city of Portage, Indiana. It's just been amazing, the change from those early days in the early 70s until now. We began, and this was prior to my getting there, of course, they began in a dilapidated old house trailer that they pulled out on the dunes there, and it was maybe a quarter mile from the docks so that Cass could go down. As I mentioned, he's Polish-American, so he spoke Polish, he spoke Russian, he spoke Romanian, several languages, and he would go to the top of the gangway and greet them in their language, which was such a key to getting access. And he would talk to the political officer about bringing the boys down after work to play soccer or to come inside and have refreshments and play chess, this, that, and the other. And that's what that they would do in the dilapidated old house trailer. And we just hosted thousands of folks that the rest of the world didn't have access to, and that those particular seafarers did not have access to coming into our country at that time because of the Cold War. They could come in on the ship, but they weren't allowed off the ship except in that kind of situation. It was simply wonderful. But volume picked up so much that it was obvious we needed more space. The port allowed us another plot of land. One of our ladies' ministries, our national ladies' ministries, put up the money to buy a second trailer. And we put them side by side about 30 feet apart. And then we had a volunteer a day when men came and raised a building between the two. So it was U-shaped. And that one-room building was a rec center with a ping-pong table and billiard table, that sort of thing. And we worked out of that particular site for many, many years. That was certainly the heyday of our volunteer participation. I would have between 600 and 700 volunteer occurrences a season at that time, drawing from the 40-plus Southern Baptist congregations in northwest Indiana. We would literally assign two or three churches for a two-week period to come together and help out at the Seafarers Mission, and it was great. It was just wonderful. That facility was followed by one that the state of Indiana built for us. The Port Commission built a wing onto their building for us to use, and it was interesting in that it was divided in half, and one half was like a banquet hall that people could rent, and they would use the proceeds from that to pay for utilities, so on and so forth, for us to use the other part to host the seafarers. We were there until it was deemed necessary to have a clinic on port because the nearest hospital was 9 miles away. And of course, ports are dangerous places. So they converted that into a clinic and they built us another facility. Interestingly enough, back on the site where we had the two trailers prior to that, they built a beautiful, probably 6 or 7 room building for us. And we were in that for 4 or 5 years. Very, very, very nice. And then, as we all recall, 9-1-1 happened. And after 9-1-1 happened, there were all of these new MARSEC regulations that told us what would happen if we moved from yellow to orange and orange to red, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the things that happens in that very first tier as you move from yellow on up is that the perimeter changes to very, very close to the docks. They wanted me and the ministry on the inside of that perimeter so that seafarers had access and I had access. So they put me in a room in one of the warehouses that was, I think, technically space for Federal Marine. I think they were kind of my hosts. I was their guests. And I was in one half of one room on the bottom of a warehouse for 3 or 4 years, and then they broke down the wall between them, and I had the entire space for about 3 or 4 more years. After that, we got busy again, and we were having to train longshoremen off the street on a daily basis, and FedNav really needed that space for a training room, and they told me that I would have to leave, and we left, and we've not had a space since. I work out of my 15-passenger van, and I go to them, and they can't come to me, which it has all worked out very well, because in that span of time, we have moved from a ship coming into port and staying 3 to 5 days to a ship coming in at 6 in the morning, hopefully leaving at 10 p.m., with, oh, one-third less crew. The companies want the same kind of production that happened in 3 to 5 days from a much smaller crew. They want in and they want out. Consequently, seafarers are not interested in coming to a seafarer center and meeting people and playing games and making their phone calls home and all of that. Again, the technology moved so much that we began in my early years with a rotary dial telephone. I'd bring a seafarer into the office with my stopwatch and a big chart, and we would talk to the operator and tell where we needed to make a long-distance call to Greece or Egypt or Philippines or whatever, and then we would time it and calculate it. Well, of course, all of that is so absurdly out of date now. Everybody's got a cell phone. Unnecessary again. So seafarers now basically are so overworked and they're so stressed that when they're in port, all they want is a quick ride to Walmart to get staples, to go back to the ship, and they can go back to the room and rest. So it has worked out well for me to be doing ministry basically on wheels for the last 9 to 10 years.
Very interesting. Marshall, when you originally started, it was more saltwater vessels, or were the Great Lakes and the Lakers involved in the mix as well?
The Lakers have always been involved in the mix because the main point of the state of Indiana building the port was to supply the newest, and it continues to be the last one that we built, integrated steel mill in the United States, which was Bethlehem Steel at Burns Harbor at that time, which was very ironic because almost from the onset, Bethlehem Steel took the government to court, and they were in court for the better part of 20 years because they didn't want to pay dock fees, et cetera, et cetera. As it turns out, they did win on that and didn't have to, but so they have their ships there every day bringing taconite and bringing limestone and all of the things that we need to make steel. And they also export from their docks. They don't do international export from the steel mill docks. We do that on the state side, but they do export slag and things like that to ports around on the Great Lakes.
Tell me a little bit about working with, let's start with the saltwater vessels. You said that they were really excited to get off of the ship. Was it really a where was the religious component as opposed to just getting them off the ship to do whatever they wanted to do for recreation?
We were very relational relative to evangelism. Very, very relational. We wanted to extend Christian hospitality, which is not the same just as general hospitality. Hospitality always has a motivation, and Christian hospitality has a motivation of sharing Jesus Christ. Consequently, we were using volunteers from our churches that had that understanding, and everything that we did was graduated toward that kind of effort. We kept the scriptures there in 60-plus languages so that we could put it in a seafarer's hands and he or she could see for themselves what that it said, and so that they could take it with them, and many times so they could take it with them back into places around the world where it was not allowed at that time. So scripture distribution was our big deal. Language scripture distribution. As the years passed, of course, that became a little more sophisticated. We were able to do recordings in other languages. We were then able to do videos in other languages. So we jumped on the bandwagon rather early with the Jesus movie, which is in many, many, many languages, and we've distributed thousands of those through the years. If they were interested, and we did occasionally find the isolated Christian aboard the ships, if they wanted to get to a church service, we would offer to take them to ours, or if they had a denomination of choice, we would offer to take them to their denomination in the area. Northwest Indiana is wonderful for that because we have lots of ethnicities here and tons of different kinds of ethnic denominations, even language churches. So we did that a lot, and that was wonderful. I mean, that was just so fantastic to take seafarers from Holland to a Dutch Reformed church here in Northwest Indiana or on the Illinois side, whatever, and some of the Orthodox groups. I would have Orthodox Catholic priests, that is to say Eastern Orthodox, and I would have Roman Catholic priests sometimes come to ships on request and do Mass or do the liturgy aboard the ships, especially for special occasions and especially if there was a peculiar need on a ship, if there were a death on the ship or something like that. And it was always so wonderful. I'll never get over how open local clergy were to reaching out to literally their own people from another part of the world while the guests in our country. And of course, we did take them to our congregations too, our supporting congregations, kind of with that understanding, hey, I want to take you to a church that's making this particular ministry possible for you. And it was obviously the first time that many of them had ever been in a Baptist or an evangelical church of any sort whatsoever. Had lots of interesting experiences and reactions to being in a Baptist church for the first time. Like, where are all the saints? Well, there aren't any saints. You're sitting with them. Oh, dear. And frequently, it made me so happy when I would bring them to Ross Baptist Church, my home congregation for the last 52 years. It would make me so happy when, after the service, a family might invite them home for lunch or something like that, and they would be in an American home for the first time. It was just cool, cool, cool. There are things like that that I miss so desperately, but, you know, the world changes. We call it progress, and sometimes I guess it is progress, but man, there's a lot of stuff we've really lost that back then was so wonderful. It made such an impact on the seafarers, and conversely, it made such an impact on the volunteers. I've got people that, well, if I'm parked in a Walmart parking lot or something, and they see this on the side of the van, Seafarer Center, they'll come up, oh, 30 years ago, when I was a teenager, my parents or my grandparents brought me out, and this happened and that happened. It just made them so happy and made such an impression on their lives.
Very good. How would you access a Soviet bloc vessel? Obviously, they had a political officer of some type on the vessel. Did you have to go through them? Was there resistance in that respect?
Well, it was a ship-to-ship sort of situation. There was always a commissar aboard. Sometimes he was a known commissar. Other times he was unknown. And, you were stopped at the top of the gangway. You did not go any farther than that. You were stopped there and asked what your business was, and you hoped to get access to an officer to make the case for, let these people off the ship. Let them onto solid ground. Let them play soccer, this, that, and the other. And, of course, this was before I was in leadership. This is when Cass Vincent was doing the leadership. It just had to be awfully diplomatic. And the key always in ministry, the international ministry back then, was language. And he had the languages. I mean, that just turned the lock, that little golden key of language, when that he would go aboard and speak one of the Slavic languages and try to get to know the people. I'm so happy to have lived through, you know, the change, you know, the thaw of the Cold War and so on and so forth, and to get to experience that on a much closer level than the general public did. You know, I was at one of the interfaces where the contact was made between East and West, and to watch them blossom as individual seafarers and people once they had a little bit of liberty and then a little bit of more liberty, and to the point today, you know, that they can all pretty much do what they want once they get here and they're approved by American Immigration for their 29-day pass. What a contrast to the beginning. What an amazing contrast.
Did they let their guard down once they were off the vessel, or were they still really cautious?
Your conservatives, like all conservatives, were leery, you know, and they watched them like a hawk. That was true of the Russian vessels. That was true of the Polish vessels. That was true of the Romanian. All of them. They were very, very vigilant that their people were not polluted by this freedom business and these free people. And again, it was an individual thing as to the individual captain and the individual political commissar. Some were totally unbending, just strack as they could be. And others, you know, they were more open, especially if food were involved. Oh. And a lot of times we would have the churches bring in a what we would call in Southern Baptist lingo, a potluck dinner. And, you know, the men would play soccer, and then we would have a lunch or a supper or a barbecue or something like that. And, oh, gosh, what an exchange that would be. And if the ship were there for more than 1 or 2 days and we had done something like that, lo and behold, in a day or two, they might bring stuff themselves to share their culture. It was, as you can tell the way I'm blubbering, it was a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful experience, a wonderful exchange. It was not at all one-sided. Both sides learned a lot. Both sides benefited a lot.
Did you ever have the occasion where you would have crews from two, maybe three vessels mingled together at the same time? Did that ever happen?
Yes, that happened frequently, and that would, in the early years, precipitate major soccer match, man. You know, we are going to play those Romanians, and we are going to teach them who's boss, that sort of thing. It was an interesting thing as well. Sometimes, as you might imagine, and I think it's probably built into your question, there were situations where that captains or commissars did not want their people mingling with those people. They would boycott that evening or whatever particular period of time that the other happened to be in port. It was interesting. It was very, very interesting that way.
The Polish crews have a strong Christian background. Were they more receptive to going to a seafarer center?
Well, Cass, of course, was Polish. So that was just huge with them. And they were very confused about Cass being Baptist, but he spoke the language. And consequently, he had probably more success with the Poles than he did with the Russians, Romanians, and Albanians, and so on and so forth, Bulgarians, probably more. We don't continue to have anything like that because that's not the world we live in anymore. We continue to have a Polish liner service that comes to the port of Indiana. And so I have Polish crews all the time. And it's interesting that you mentioned, you know, a religious group of people, strong Roman Catholic. So it's been interesting to watch what has happened with the advent of the EU. And it's very distressing to the older, there's two kinds of conservatives with the Poles, the older conservative Catholics and the older conservative communists, because they are more threatened by what the EU has brought to Polish culture than what the thaw in the Cold War and relationships with the United States brought to the culture. They really are distressed about the erosion among their youth in Catholic faith. Very, very much so. They talk to me about it all the time. I enjoy when that they're here taking them to it's not a monastery. It is a ministry that the Roman Catholic Church, a Polish language ministry that all around the world, Salvatorian Fathers, they have a large place here in Gary. And I will take anybody that wants to go to Mass there on Sunday, and they're sitting on 7 acres, and there's 7 or 8 Polish priests assigned there all the time. And it's a great experience for them to be at home in the middle of America. And I have a pretty good relationship with those fellas at that particular ministry. But they're on a rotation basis, just like any other missionary group would be. So faces change, so on and so forth. But that has been a really positive thing for me personally to get to work with them and for the Polish guys on the ship to get to go to this place where they can interface with the American Polish community, not only in worship, but in great big picnics and particularly some Polish holidays and things like that. I know I can go to Salvatorian Fathers and plug them into that.
Did it change during the Solidarity Movement in the Polish countries?
Yeah, I had such an experience with that. And, you know, that was shortly after I started volunteering.
Right.
I think it nailed down my commitment to this particular ministry, because at the time I was volunteering, I was full-time steelworker at U.S. Steel in Gary, and I was full-time student at IU Northwest, and I was probably quarter-time at the church as the organist and Sunday school teacher, that sort of thing. But one of one of my first intense experiences with seafarers was with a couple of Polish cadets. I had been volunteering, and this is sometime after things had thawed somewhat. The restrictions weren't as great, and I could take them off port. And we had discussed going to worship on Sunday in a Baptist church, and afterwards going and doing a tour of Chicago and going up the Sears Tower, etc., etc. So this really caught the imagination of two of these cadets, and they agreed to do that. Again, there's always a language problem. One of them was shocked to death when we ended up at the Baptist church, and he said, "You told me we were going to the warship." He thought he was going to get a tour of a battleship. No, not warship, worship. So he was a little bit taken aback and somewhat offended. I think he thought he had been fooled, which was not our purpose at all. But we did the worship service, and then we went and we did a wonderful day in Chicago. As a matter of fact, we had lunch with Mom and Dad at their house after church and then went to Chicago. And we just had this amazing experience. You and I remember that was the time of Jaruzelski and the Polish Spring. Well, we exchanged addresses and all of that sort of thing, which was very common for us to do with seafarers, and they sailed away. And the one young man got back home, I think, probably on leave or between semesters for his schooling or whatever, and sent me back a beautiful letter. But the unpleasant thing about it was in transit of that letter was when they clamped down again. No more of this Polish Spring thing. Now, I'm a little bit confused. You'll have to help me with our history here. Was it Jaruzelski that had been responsible for the thaw, or was it Jaruzelski that brought the hammer back down?
I am not 100% certain. I think he brought the hammer back down.
Okay, well, he brought the hammer back down, and the upshot of that is I never heard from either of the two young men again. And if you don't think that that didn't work on the psyche and the heart of a 23, 24-year-old man to understand and appreciate the liberty that we take for granted, the way that it was jerked out from under them like that, it was just, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And what a happy thing to be able to live and watch all of the different movements that happened as the dominoes fell and all of the liberation movements happened for all of those people in the former Soviet bloc. Fantastic, the difference of day and night.
Did you ever have instances, Marshall, where someone would want to defect?
Frequently. That would happen frequently. Sometimes they would simply walk away and never be heard from again. Other times it would get to be very dramatic with immigration and border patrol involved. Sometimes it was just comical. I mean, we had a ship come in with a lot of North Africans aboard one time. And just, I mean, basically no sooner than the thing tied up, people started walking off the ship and walking toward the highway. It was amazing. And of course, there were all of these border patrol agents that somehow were involved early on, and they were rounding them up and taking them back to the ship. But a lot of people through the years, an awful lot of people through the years, got off the ship and never, ever went back home. A lot of times it was well planned. A lot of times I was involved unknowingly. You know, I'd say 6 o'clock, I'll bring the van, and we're going to go to Walmart, everybody get in that wants to go. And, you know, I'd pick up 12 guys, and when we would rendezvous to take them back, there'd only be 11, and everybody, you know, well, where's Pedro? I don't know, you know, I saw him in the store a time or two, but whatever. And, of course, he had been in contact with family or contacts or whatever, and arranged a rendezvous, and you'd never, ever see him again. It happened frequently, and I would get these phone calls from immigration. Did you have so-and-so? I don't know who I had in the van. I don't know their names, whatever. Then they would come over and show me a picture from the passport. Oh, yeah, I saw this guy. Here's what happened. And once in a while, they would call me. These guys would call me after they got somewhere with second thoughts. What should I do? What should I do? And, you know, I would always encourage them, you know, it's okay. It's safe in our country to turn yourself in. Here's what you do. And I don't think that ever happened. Many times it's unfortunately because they were taken a terrible advantage of by people of their ethnicity that were already here. You know, they would basically put them in slave labor sometimes with the threat of, you know, oh, if the authorities get you, all of the horrible things that would happen.
Interesting. So the fear of their own government was pretty powerful to make them want to leave a ship.
Yeah, and then the threat of what the American government would do if they caught them. And you know what's going to happen if the American government sends you home, you traitor, you. Oh, gosh. You know, if you look at the history of our country, for that matter, if you look at the history of the world,
right.
Immigration has had a whole lot of its history written by seafarers jumping ship or seafarers leaving children. You talk about the gene pool. Seafarers have done their part to keep the gene pool interesting.
Sure, sure. When did the Southeast Asian crews, when did those vessels become prominent in Indiana?
I cannot give you a date. I can't remember a particular time that I saw a shift, as it were. You know, the reason we were seeing the Soviets and the Poles and the Romanians, Albanians, and what's next door to Albania? Come on now.
Bulgaria.
Yugoslavia. Oh, yeah, Yugoslavia. That was fun to watch. To watch that fall apart, you know, after all of that very good work that Marshal Tito did to keep them all together, then to watch it completely dissolve. That all happened because of us giving the grain away. I don't believe we gave grain away to the Chinese. I don't remember it at this point. So there was not that trigger to suck them into the Great Lakes where that we have the great surplus of the corn, wheat, and soybeans, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. I think if I had had a West Coast experience or something, it might have been something that I experienced a little differently. Now, I do want you to understand, as you know so well, Great Lakes shipping is seasonal. You know, we're about a 9 to 10 month season. Then everything's dead for 2 to 3 months. With the exception of this year, which I think was the fourth or the fifth time, since 1987, I have always spent time in Houston, Texas. The first time was in 87 when I went down for 2 weeks for the only training that was available to do a formation for a chaplain. It was ecumenical. It was Catholics and Baptists and Methodists and everybody else. It was a great experience. I was watching one of our little news outlets for the ministry the next year and saw that one of the staff members there was having hip replacement surgery and would be out for a year. So I phoned them and said, hey, you know, I'm not working at that time because I'm frozen off. How about me coming down and helping fill in? Well, they were fine with that. And I had a great time. They had a great time. And I've done it ever since. So there is where I have had so much more of my experience with Chinese and Indo-Chinese and people from that particular corner of the world is in Houston, Texas. As a matter of fact, we had a Roman Catholic Chinese priest on our staff there, and that opened my eyes to an awful lot of things relative to ministering to the very, very standoffish, very suspicious Chinese. They still have commissars aboard. They still have commissars aboard, and they are shortly, I believe, going to be the number one in terms of bodies aboard ships, the number one group sailing. You know, it's been the Filipinos for the past 20, 30 years because they're a seafaring nation and they speak English. Everybody wants them. They are toxically docile, and they do what they're told, so on and so forth, and they work for very little money. Well, now the Chinese are going to take that particular space. And once the Chinese get a handle on the English language, I think everybody else is going to be looking for work.
Wow, very interesting.
Oh, gosh, yes. Very much so. It's been interesting to watch companies. And, you know, I'm not a liberal by any sense of the word, but I have certainly seen how business is about the bottom line. And I've watched them move from one ethnicity to another ethnicity to another ethnicity as groups learn to stand up for themselves, like the Filipinos and the Indian seafarers, so on and so forth. You just keep going to another country. You go to Burma, or you go to China, or you go to Kiribati, or something like that. So interesting working with Kiribatis and other people from the Marshall Islands through the years. You know, they barely have a concept of money. You know, why are you sailing? Well, that's what we do. Oh, my gosh. This particular ministry is such an education. I mean to tell you, there's no learning all of it. And every time you think you've got something down, it shifts.
Did you, getting back to that question I forgot earlier, did you get into trouble with immigration or with the port? Were they sort of clamping down on, you know, if someone was defecting, did they come down hard on you? Or the ministry?
I would have individuals think they could do that, and I would just remind them, we're in the United States of America, pal. And, you know, then they just mumble under their breath, that sort of thing. They couldn't really. I never did anything, none of my people ever did anything that was cooperative with an effort to get a person to defect or immigrate or anything like that. So you get these folks that had a warped view of American law and so on and so forth and think, you know, that they could do something like that. But I knew better and helped them, and I helped them understand better as well.
I would assume you had repeat visitors from the ships over the years. Did that happen regularly?
In the early years, not so much. And that was something when I would go on speaking tours and so on and so forth, I would tell people, you know, this is a very frustrating ministry because I see somebody for 2 or 3, 4 days and then they're gone forever. That's why I want you to give me Bibles to send home with them, you know, that sort of thing. But if we have a liner service, like I mentioned, Polish Ocean Lines, and certainly with the Americans and the Canadians, which my ministry shifted maybe halfway through to emphasis on saltwater to the emphasis on American Canadians. Yeah, I see some of them as like on a weekly basis on the motor vessel Stuart J. Court, the motor vessel Burns Harbor, the motor vessel Joseph L. Block. All of those, I see those guys on kind of a weekly basis, either at Burns Harbor, Indiana Harbor, or in Chicago. I know a lot of them very, very personally. I've been to some of their homes. I've been to some of their funerals, that sort of thing. And I love that. I love that as opposed to the way it was for the first several years, where that it was just hi and goodbye forever. I like the relationship aspect of it very, very much.
So tell me a little bit, Marshall, about this shift. I think of the type of work you do as more of an international aspect. The fact that you're on Great Lakes Canadian-American vessels somewhat surprised me. How did that
you said that happened all the time, but tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I tell people, you know, that I actually have kind of three differently defined ministries, maybe four. And, you know, it's the international saltwater vessel, goes everywhere in the world. Must be no longer than 730 feet long, because the locks are in the Welland Canal around Niagara Falls are only 730 feet long. But if they can meet that criteria, 90 feet wide, 730 feet long, they can come in. They're going to come in 1,200 miles one way just to get to Burns Harbor. Then they got to cover that all the way just to get to go right there at the mouth of the St. Lawrence to get onto the ocean again, the Atlantic Ocean. So that's one group that I deal with. A second group is, and it's in two sections, is the American and Canadian Great Lakes Seafarers. Totally different thing. They're at home. They're at home when they get here, the Americans are. They're at home pretty much when they get here, the Canadians are. They don't have the language problem. They don't have the currency problem. They don't have 4011 different problems that you would have with the saltwater crew. But they are different as well. Canadian crew is not an American crew, and vice versa. There are distinctives between them that I found out, you know, through experience that you have to be aware of and deal with. The protections for Americans and Canadian seafarers are much different from the lack of protection, by and large, of international seafarers. And a lot of our work is advocacy. So, you know, advocacy with the international seafarer, you're going to be using the International Transport Workers Federation and their agents, or you're going to be using Center for Seafarers' Rights, which is part of the Seamen's Church Institute, something like that. Americans, on the other hand, have their unions, and so you're going to refer them to their union steward or something like that if there's a problem. There's a difference in access, like to medical care, between your saltwater people and your American and Canadians. So your American and Canadians, obviously you're going to have a difference because one's socialized medicine in Canada and the other's private medicine here in the United States. You know, so there's three. Now the fourth is I will occasionally work with brown water. I will occasionally work with tugboats that are coming off the river system, and they'll shoot across here real quick to Burns Harbor or to Indiana Harbor, certainly in Chicago. Small crews on a tugboat, some of them home every night, some of them going on the boat for 60 days and then home for 30 days, that sort of thing. And a very different demographic. The brown water people are, it's just a case of its own, very much so. So that's the four groups that basically that I deal with a lot. I've told people that ask, that are curious about the ministry, you know, like by security guards, Marshall, when do you want us to call you to let you know there's a crew here? Said, any time it's floating and there's people aboard. Don't call me out for a barge that somebody's tied up and left, because there won't be any people aboard. But if they tie up on the side with the tugboat, there's going to be people aboard. Call me. That's my mission field.
Okay. How do you access these facilities now in the era of Homeland Security?
That really got interesting, especially right after the very confusing regulations went into effect. We're still sorting all of that out. You've got a TWIC card, I suppose.
Yes.
Okay. Well, you know, that was just a huge mess. 10 years into the TWIC card, they didn't have readers. Now some places have readers and don't use them.
Yes.
There's all of that. And I have experienced, because of the ridiculous size of the Port of Houston, I've experienced more of the difference between security plans between private docks down there than I do up here, where most of the stuff is state docks and so on and so forth. But you'll get this security officer at one company that is just sure that he's saving America by keeping the commies out and all of that sort of thing, and he sees you as a co-conspirator, and you're not coming in here, and then you've got to call supervisors, and then you've got to write letters and all of that kind of stuff. And you go right next door, right across the fence to another company, and basically it's a hand wave to the security guard that's seen you 10 times before and knows that you're okay. It's been very interesting. It's been a learning experience for everybody. We continue to learn, and we continue to see changes. Just in the last year, part of the Coast Guard reg spells out very clearly that you have to give access on your property to chaplains and to union officials.
I know I've run across a lot of difficult situations around the Great Lakes with every dock being different, as you said, with the security guards think they have a power that is way beyond what they're mandated to do.
Way, way beyond. I had a situation in Milwaukee, and I think that situation continues to persist, that after the longshoremen finish their work and go home, they lock a gate where no one can go in and go out. Wait a minute. You know, immigration has given these men a 29-day pass, and they have every right that you have to go wherever they please. What are you doing locking them in like that? And, you know, just in terms of safety's sake, what if there's an explosion or a fire? You've got these people locked in behind, you know, a metal fence. Come on. Really? And I had a passenger aboard one of the cargo ships. That's a big deal, passengers on cargo ships. And she writes for two or three of the different cargo ship passenger magazines. And, man, she raised the roof about that. She was in contact with everybody. But we did not make a lot of headway with it. I don't know if they're still practicing that or not at that particular dock. But you get that kind of craziness. I mean, I'm a conservative Republican. Jeez, oh, you know, I've broadened my horizons enough through my work to understand that there are some paranoias that there's no way that you can make sense of them, and there's no way that you can communicate them. And when that is the case, you might want to step back and examine them and decide if maybe they're out of place.
I have heard the same thing even with American crews at certain docks, that they're not really allowed or able to get off because they're locked in, which is against your civil rights as a citizen.
Oh, it's horrible. And that drives me crazy. An American crew on an American ship in American waters with an American cargo going between American ports. How is that any different from Joe Blow going to the office at 8 a.m. in the morning and driving home at 4? How is that any different? You know, they've not been to another port outside the country. None of the above. How is that different? I'm so disappointed, frequently disappointed, with our American maritime unions. How little that they have done to demand the respect that they should have as American citizens. Just, don't get me started.
You're very passionate about that, I can tell.
Oh, God have mercy. I just, you know, our seafarers have enough problem with the management. They're paying you dues to, and you shouldn't be a second management that's against them. You should certainly be working for them, and you should be a firebrand about the whole thing. Hasn't it been interesting to watch this Long Beach business right now?
I'm not up to date on that one.
Okay, well, there are like 700 ships waiting to come in to Long Beach.
Oh, is that still happening? I know that was a few years ago they were having that.
Well, that's when they had that strike, which backfired so dreadfully. Right now, they're having the problem because we got tons of longshoremen there that have caught COVID. So that there's no people to unload the ships. You know, so it got to crisis proportions, and two or three weeks ago, they prioritized vaccinating longshoremen. Well, duh. I was part of a conference call, a Zoom meeting, two or three days ago. We have a new man in Siemens Church Institute in New Orleans who has taken over Center for Seafarers' Rights that Doug Stevenson used to be at there in New York. And we were interviewing him. We were all asking questions, 4011 questions of the poor guy. And the thing came up about access to ships because of fears of COVID. This past season, I did all of my ministry, or 95% of it, from over the side of the ship, especially salt waters. They did not want me aboard. And they did not want their people off the ship. That was also true of many of my American and all of my Canadian ships, as a matter of fact. So we were asking, Phil, about vaccinations for seafarers. And, you know, he basically drew the same sort of parameters that I drew for you a little bit earlier about it's going to be very different for American seafarers going to American ports and for American seafarers going to international ports and then for international seafarers coming from everywhere and going everywhere. What do you do? How can you do it? Well, you know, I didn't contribute. You know, my answer to the whole thing is Johnson & Johnson. It's a one-shot pop. And, you know, then you're going to have a credential that shows you had it, which, of course, we're all carrying our little shot record in our pocket from getting the Moderna and the Pfizer. That was my thought on that. You know, if seafarers can't have the luxury that the rest of us do of make an appointment 3 weeks out to come back again for 4 weeks out for the Moderna, give them the one-shot pop, and then they've got it. And, by golly, give them priority. You know, talk about essential workers. Please, there's nobody more essential than seafarers. Nobody. The world economy rides on the sore backs of seafarers. No two ways about it. It has always been that way. It is going to continue that way for the foreseeable future. People don't understand what they owe seafarers.
They move everything. Everything in the world moves by water.
Yeah, there's a book by some lady out on the East Coast, 90% of Everything is the title of it. And that's what she talks about. And, you know, it's confirmed. It's been confirmed over and over and over again. Wake up, John Q. Public, to the reality that your affluence is all thanks to seafarers, whether they're international, whether they're Great Lakes, whether they're brown water or whatever. Those lovely things you take for granted have moved on water 9 times out of 10.
I had heard, changing topic a little bit, from some of the people on the Great Lakes that they had pitched in and bought you a new van. Can you tell me a little bit about that story?
Yes, that happened the day after Christmas in 2018. The chief mate aboard the motor vessel Burns Harbor started a GoFundMe. And the GoFundMe was buy Marshall a new van. The old van had about 370,000 miles to its credit. The thing started just fine. The original air conditioning still worked. I mean, you talk about a testimony to Chevrolet. It certainly was. However, just like with us old guys like myself, the body starts to go. And it was rusting here, there, and yon. It just looked awful. The interior was fading away as well. And he got tired of riding around with me in something that made him look bad. so he started that GoFundMe, and he contacted the heads of several of the shipping companies, and our local company here, Central Marine, they jumped on the bandwagon immediately and plopped down $5,000 and basically sent out a challenge to the rest of the industry. And in 2 or 3 weeks' time, they raised about $31,000. And like I say, he did that the day after Christmas 2018. 3 or 4 weeks later, they laid up his ship for winter layup, probably in Milwaukee, but I'm not sure. He drove down in a rental car because his truck was parked at Bethlehem Steel. We turned in the rental car, we hopped in his truck, we went to his home in Detroit and spent the night, which was the first night of that terrible blizzard we had that year. We got up the next morning into his truck, drove through the blizzard to Findlay, Ohio, where he had located this wonderful van, and we made the exchange with the dealership there, and I drove home in the beautiful new van in that blizzard all along the shore of Lake Erie. And as soon as we got over the Indiana border, the storm ended. And I've been using the van ever since. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. It's just a delight. And it was very affirming for seafarers making a contribution at $20 and the companies making contributions upwards of $5,000 to do this for the ministry, for themselves as well. You know, that component is there, but it was very, very needful and extremely appreciated.
Do you feel somewhat abandoned by the port of Indiana Harbor, Burns Harbor, and the churches for not supporting you and leaving you to work as an independent?
You know, I could do that pretty easily and I decided not to early on.
Okay.
You know, I look at how they're involved with other things, and, you know, they would not really be expected to do. And I've been thoroughly blessed in the past with things that certainly that the state of Indiana had done for us, although that is history at this point. No, I don't really hold any sort of grudge against the state or the port authorities. I think port authorities need to have a greater sensitivity toward people in general. You know, remember it's people that make this work. Remember management at ArcelorMittal Steel. It's not called that now. They've been sold. Do they have a new name?
I don't know. I'm not even sure. Is it Cliffs that bought them?
Yeah, Cleveland Cliffs bought them. I was over there last night. I have to drive through the gate once every 3 weeks and use my gate key, or it dies, and then you have to go through all kinds of hoops. So I did that last night, but I didn't notice any change in signs. I think it still said ArcelorMittal. But ArcelorMittal, you've got to realize, there is no steel mill except for people that bring you the ore. Port of Indiana, you've got to remember, there is no Port of Indiana. There is no grain. There are no windmills, et cetera, except for people. And, you know, they are sacrificing so much more than you are sacrificing for your career, because you get to have your family and you get to have access to your family every day. These people leave home and they're gone months at a time without their own language, without their own money, without their own kind of ethnic food, etc., etc., without their church, etc., etc., etc. Remember that. And there is an insensitivity that just will not die.
Mm-hmm. Marshall, what do you think is the greatest need for sailors today for your services?
What they appreciate that I do more than anything is transportation. They're fine moving on water, but once they tie up, it's like a turtle on its back. And they're at the mercy of taxi drivers and Uber drivers and that sort of thing, if they can get to the gate. You know, at ArcelorMittal there at Burns Harbor, it's 2.5-3 mile drive from the dock to the gate. So the transportation, the van, that's really, really important to my Americans and Canadians, and as well as my internationals. I used to tell people there were two things, that there was transportation and communication, because I would take them to the Seafarer Center and help them make that telephone call. Or then, as times changed, I would take them phone cards. They could purchase a phone card to use to talk to anywhere in the world. Okay, that changed. Then we were taking them cell phones that they could use while that they were here. Then they got their own cell phones. That changed. Now we take them SIM cards, so that the SIM cards will give them internet access when they're in port. And once they're on the internet, the world is their cherry, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So it used to be transportation and communication was what was most important, very, very much most important.
Is there still a large volume of saltwater vessels? I know FedNav goes into Burns Harbor frequently.
Yes, we still have a very respectable high number of saltwater ships coming into the Midwest at Burns Harbor, Indiana Harbor, Gary Harbor, and Chicago. I left out Buffington Harbor. That's basically between Gary and Indiana Harbor.
Are there other ministries around the Great Lakes that you are in contact with, say the Port of Duluth? Or
there are two at Duluth Superior. One of them is kind of a full gospel church sort of thing, and they're basically, they emphasize evangelism. I've never had face-to-face contact with them. On Duluth, on the other hand, there is a wonderful ecumenical group, basically Lutheran-led, that will do a wonderful ministry with saltwater ships. Now, they don't have much to do with Americans and Canadians, and, you know, when I hear my Americans and Canadians grouse about that, I tell them, well, did you call them? No. You know, well, contact them and see what they will offer. But they have a lovely facility. They have a great volunteer corps, and they do good work. I hear they do a great Christmas project, putting packages aboard the ships, like most of us do. And we had a fellow at the locks on the Canadian side, Father Brodeur, for many years. I don't know if he's still living or not, much less if there's still a ministry there. There's been two or three ministries through the years in Milwaukee that have petered out. I had a friend, and we put together a small board of directors trying to resurrect a ministry there. We worked on that 5 or 6 years, and then we just had to throw up our hands and quit. We just couldn't make it happen. But an interesting thing from that was that during that time, we went a little farther north to Marinette. What's the twin city with Marinette?
Menominee.
Menominee, and we found an old hippie, Jesus people kind of guy. We're doing his little charismatic church there, and we got him involved with ship visiting, and I don't know what he's still doing that. I'm not in contact with him, he's not in contact with us, but I hear from seafarers that they're visited by someone when that they're there. We watched three separate ministries, Roman Catholic, Anglican, and Dutch Reformed, that were marvelous in Chicago. We've watched each of them fade away as their leaders died out, and now that's my bailiwick, unfortunately. So my ship agents will let me know when they've got a ship up there that definitely needs a chaplain's visit or a run to Walmart or something like that. That is the trend around the world, is leadership dies out or the denomination loses interest that was supporting it, and what used to be a very vibrant, good ministry is then gone.
What is your future?
My future looks like that. You know, I do not have an heir apparent whatsoever. It's interesting because, as I described to you, the situation of my going to Houston, at least during 2 weeks of February every year, sometimes as many as 8 and 10 weeks. But 2 weeks every February, we bring in 12 people from around the world to train them intensively to do this kind of work. And sometimes they're sent by their mission society, which might be Missions to Seafarers, an Anglican group, or it might be Apostleship of the Sea, a Catholic group. Could be a lot of, we have a lot of independents that come, whatever. And we train those 12 people and send them out. We've done 2 or 3 guys from Dubai, and but there's no one interested in going to a situation that won't support them. Mm-hmm. That is to say, where there's not a salary, where there's not a paycheck, and there's not here. I live on handouts for the last 10 years. Fortunately, God provides. And that has been a wonderful spiritual lesson that I have had to revisit over and over and over again. Don't worry. Don't worry. Don't worry. God provides. And he does. He provides vans. We have some other van providers, by the way. I mentioned International Transport Workers Federation. They frequently give out grants for organized ministries, that is to say ministries that have a board and that sort of thing, which I don't. But they will frequently give them money to buy a van or to build a facility, something like that. They will not pay salaries or that sort of thing, but they like to do brick-and-mortar things for us.
Was the internet a big factor in things changing in terms of what the needs are for seafarers? And
yes, it has really helped in terms of seafarers being involved with their family. You can do FaceTime with your kids, and they know it's not just a photograph on the wall that mom points to and talks about. There's dad. He's live. I can see him. I can see his mouth moving. I can hear what he's saying. I can hear him telling me to behave myself and obey my mother, that sort of thing. And when he's, you know, when the seafarer is talking to his wife and she can see his face and she can see his eyes, he is a whole lot less likely to stray. Seafarers have told us that too, that it helps strengthen marriage for them to be able to use their computer to see and to hear their family. And of course, it's, you know, it has affected their lives the same way it has ours with everything else too. They can make travel arrangements really, really quickly. They can buy stuff and they can have it sent to the next port, frequently send it to the Seafarer Center. Then when the ship gets there, a good-hearted chaplain will bring it to the ship or something like that. It's helped them with their education and getting their credentials. You know, so much of this stuff for the seafarer is online now. And he doesn't have to fly down to Florida. He doesn't have to fly to California or New York City to get the courses. He can do the courses while he's on the ship. And he's there on the ship with 22 other people, many of which have already done it. So they can help him out with it, that sort of thing. Oh, yeah. It's had as much impact there as it has on the shoreside.
You sort of work 24/7, don't you? When the ships are in, I recall meeting you. I think it was 2 a.m. in the galley.
Yeah, I tell the boys leave me alone from 11 to 5 a.m. unless there's blood. If there's blood, you call. But a lot of them will forget that, and a lot of them will text me at that time thinking that, you know, he'll see this in the morning. Well, the phone's right beside my pillow, you know, ping. I know that there's a text there. So yeah, it's a 24/7. Now that brings up an interesting issue for me now, though, in the particular juncture that I am in my life right now. Dad is 92 and Mom is 88, and they live 3 miles from my house. And they are, on a daily basis, there are more issues on a daily basis. So I was just telling my sister and some other folks last night, this season, Mom and Dad may be priority one, and the seafarers may be priority two. We're going to just have to see how that works out.
Right. One more question before I let you go.
As many questions as you want.
First of all, I really appreciate your time for this, Marshall. When we had driven through the steel mill, you were pointing out when I remember there was something, they were burning something, and you said it's the brimstone. You had related that steel experience. Can you tell me a little bit about that? That still stuck with me, you know, that.
Okay, they're not creating brimstone. Brimstone is burning sulfur. That's what gives us that horrible acrid smell. And there is sulfur involved in the steel-making process. I don't think they ever add sulfur, per se, but, you know, in the process of melting the iron ore and the... Okay, what's calcium carbonate? The easier word. Why did the easier word go away? Limestone. The limestone and the iron ore and the coke, and in the sintering plant, when that they're doing that particular process, you're going to get the... horrible sulfur, burning sulfur smell. You get this burning sulfur light from a fusee. You know, you see the fusees when they throw them out the railroad tracks, the little red light. Okay, that's what it looks like. But you smelled the brimstone when you and I were passing by the sintering plant, and that awful, awful smell. And it's been known as an awful, awful smell for over 2,000 years because it's hellfire and brimstone. Okay, that's the smell that they're talking about in the Bible when they talk about hellfire and brimstone.
Amazing. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
I will look forward to hearing from you again. My 2021 season will begin for me tonight. I've received a message from a man that will be flying in from Florida. He is the chief cook for the motor vessel Joseph L. Block. I'm going to go to O'Hare Airport about 10 o'clock tonight and meet his plane and bring him back into Northwest Indiana. I'll install him in a motel somewhere here, and he will make connections to get aboard the ship. He's a Jamaican-American, and his crew just worships the ground he walks on because he provides some really delectable meals, 3 times a day, 7 days a week. I'm looking forward to seeing him, and I know that his crew is looking forward to.
So fit out is soon.
Fit out has begun on the Great Lakes. 2 or 3 vessels already have crews aboard. I don't know that anybody is moving yet, but they certainly will be sometime early. This is Saturday. Sometime midweek next week, there will be ships moving. That's for sure.
Another year.
Here we go again.
Here we go. Thank you very much, Marshall. I really appreciate it.
You take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. This concludes this Inland Mariner's audio interview. Thank you for listening. This audio program has been presented by the Inland Mariner's Cypress Pictures LLC and Patrick Lipinski. To hear more, go to inlandmariners.com.